Service centers would be comfortable with that. I don't know how that would affect other clinics. I think you should hear from other kinds of clinics. There's a state standard for doing that.
There's some counselors in this field that are not licensed, isn't that correct? Because we have a bill, I know school counselors, and I'm not so sure that family counselors are something that are not licensed because they've introduced a bill for the last couple of sessions. So that's another concern. There's a group of people out there that do not have a state licensure procedure.
There are people in the room, I'm sure, who could explain better than I can about the different levels. I'm asking you to just pick one that's lower so that more kids will be able to walk into places where they feel comfortable to get this kind of treatment, because I think it definitely needs to be done. You already said in 1981 it definitely needed to be done, and in Portland at least things have only gotten worse. So I'd like to see you say it again, and the governor not to veto it this time.
Any further questions? If not, thank you, Ms. Bogan.
And
if you want to submit anything to us in writing in terms of additional comments or suggested amendments, we'll be glad to receive those. Thank you.
Okay, John McKelly. You want to rain on this parade, right? No. Okay.
My name is John McCulley, representing the Oregon Psychiatric Association. The association at their last legislative committee meeting did take a stand in opposition to the bill as it was written for fear that we would be establishing a state policy here which they felt was not clinically sound, and that is not involving family members in the treatment process, and they felt that that was clinically not a good idea. I have just had a chance to review the amendments that Dr. King presented to the committee, and before adamantly espousing that position of opposition, would like to take these back to the psychiatrist and have them look at that, because I think he does address some of those concerns in his amendments.
Appreciate that, John. Any questions at this point? I don't know your time frame, but it's possible work session could be scheduled within a couple weeks, so if you can let us know within that period of time.
Mr. Chair, we have a meeting tomorrow night.
Okay. Good timing. Thanks. Anything else? Thank you. Carla Mickelson? Michelson?
My name is Carla Michelson, and I'm here today representing the Juvenile Rights Project. Unfortunately, we have an illness in our staff attorney group, and everybody else got scheduled, so they gave me their testimony and told me to come here. I'm afraid I won't be able to answer a lot of your very technical questions, but I'll do my best. For the sake of time, I'll try not to read the whole letter, and I'll try to hit the points that Ms. McFarland, who drafted this, asked me to bring into the record. The Juvenile Rights Project suggests two minor amendments to House Bill 2651, and with those amendments, we would support the bill. The Los Angeles Times has reported that in 1983, there were 40 million Americans between the ages of 10 and 21, and at least 7.3 million children and youth in the United States are suffering from psychiatric disease or disability. Some of the previous testimony has touched on the reasons that Julie gives for why juveniles don't always want or can get consent from their parents, and I'll try to get through those. One group that would not be able to get parental consent is juveniles who've been emancipated, forced out of their home, or who have run away, and they can't get consent because their parents are not available or the parents lack the desire or willingness to get involved. The General Accounting Office has estimated that 1 million children are absent from their home each year. About half of those are pushed out by their parents, and about the other half run away. Another group who can't get parental consent are juveniles whose parents are the problem. And those are parents who physically, emotionally, or sexually abused the child in the first place. Some of the parents are alcoholic or drug addicted themselves, and sometimes the parents themselves are mentally ill. And it says that between 1979 and 1981, there was a 106% increase in child abuse reports nationwide, and the child abuse death-related deaths have increased nationally also. Juveniles cannot obtain counseling if parental consent is required, sometimes because of the sensitive nature of the problem. And juveniles who are suicidal, juveniles with alcohol and drug addictions, and juveniles with problems resulting from sexual activity are frequently reluctant to go to their parents for consent. It's estimated that nationally 7,000 teenagers kill themselves and as many as 400,000 attempt suicide every year. And the rate of suicide among juvenile males has increased 400% over what it was 30 years ago. I'm not going to go into the common law issues here because it would be better to do that at a work session where you have an attorney. So I'll address the amendments that we're proposing, and they are attached in the back of that. There are numerous professionals and agencies willing and able to provide free counseling services to troubled adolescents. We feel that all these professionals and agencies should have the onus of civil liability removed so these services can be provided. Section 2 of 2651 would allow only those agencies which have been established as community mental health programs subject to the rules of the Mental Health Division and designated as such by the county in which they operate to treat adolescents without civil liability. Many juvenile serving agencies do not receive Mental Health Division funds and consequently are not included in the Section 2 definition. Many excellent services are thus excluded from this definition, including the youth service centers in Portland, programs set up and funded by the Juvenile Services Commissions, and programs established by juvenile departments, such as diversion programs for alcohol and drug-dependent youths. Section 2 should be amended to extend the protection from civil liability to these and other agencies. And you have the amendment. We also offer a small amendment to Section 3 to require the professional or agency to advise the juvenile of any intention to disclose information about the juvenile's diagnosis or treatment to the parent. This amendment, we feel, is consistent with the purposes of the Act, which is encouraging juveniles to obtain confidential treatment. Many Oregon children suffer from serious psychiatric disease and disability that, if left untreated, could lead to suicide or result in lifelong harm or, in some cases, institutionalization. We urge you to send House Bill 2654 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Again, we're familiar with the written materials of the Juvenile Rights Project, and I think they're probably sufficient to assist us in understanding your position. And I don't think any questions at this point in terms of amendments are, I think it's pretty clear what you presented.
I did want to say that Julie McFarlane is also on the board of directors of Outside In, and she indicated that the way the law is now with medical treatment, that some counseling centers who have a physician on their staff have interpreted that to mean that it is possible for them to give mental health treatment to adolescents under the aegis of the medical treatment, and that they would like to have that clarified because it has been ambiguous.
Okay, we've had reference to a couple of those statutes earlier in 109, 610, and 640. We'll make a note to counsel to check that point, and you might also let Ms. McFarland know that the proponents have come up with some substantial set of amendments that she will probably want to review before the next part, hearing or work session, and that she can contact Mr. King to obtain those, or our counsel. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Appreciate it. Michael Crummell.
position here.
Good afternoon or good evening.
My name is Michael Krummel, and I come as a member of the State Alcohol and Drug Office's Prevention Early Intervention Advisory Committee. I'm also president of the City of Eugene's Commission on the Rights of Youth, and although I don't formally represent their views here, I would like to have acknowledged the fact that we have discussed this matter in commission meetings, and I think I fairly represent the majority viewpoint of that commission with my testimony here this evening. Third, and perhaps most significant, is the fact that I am a youth program manager for a state-approved outpatient facility in Eugene that deals with a very large number of adolescents who are experiencing problems with their own drug and alcohol use, as well as children who come from families where the parents are alcoholic or drug addicted. And to that point, I would like to preface my other comments with a brief story. This is an actual case in which I initially became involved with a 17-year-old high school student in September of last year. And on initial contact, found out that she was living in a family with two alcoholic parents, actively alcoholic parents. And in the course of my initial informal contacts with this young lady, I discovered that, in fact, living in that family situation was creating a lot of stress for her, and she appeared to be someone who was a prime candidate for the services that we were offering. I might add another preface here in that in my role as a program coordinator in Eugene, I supervise clinical service provision to high school students in three schools. We are objectified in the state grant to provide services to 185 kids in the fiscal year, and in actuality, because of our high visibility and our role in the schools, I would anticipate that we probably will make direct contact with as many as 300 kids in this fiscal year who approach us or who we approach because of a serious interest in involving them in some sort of mental health treatment service or drug and alcohol prevention early intervention service. To get back to my story, at the point that I recognized that this particular 17-year-old was appropriate for some services in our program, I let her know and encouraged her to go home and seek the consent of her parents so that she could legally participate in our program. And she was somewhat tentative, perhaps not surprisingly so, because her report of her parents' alcoholic behavior included the fact that they were steeped in heavy denial and were not acknowledging that there were problems going on there. But she said that she would go home, she would attempt to get their consent. The upshot was that she came back several days later and said that she was unable to get consent and had in fact been ordered by her father to totally eliminate any contact with our program office. At that point, I just found out from her that she had a 14-year-old sister in the same school that I was working in. And despite the fact that the older sister was constrained from seeing us anymore, because the younger sister had not acknowledged to her parents that she was also interested in seeing us, she continued to make a variety of frequent number of informal contacts with us. And in the context of those contacts with us, she would frequently drop references to the fact that she was engaging in a variety of what I would call self-destructive sexual behaviors in the community, that she was occasionally dropping hints of suicidal thought, and that she was frequently abusing drugs, including alcohol and in some cases narcotic drugs. I knew the status of our ability to get her involved in program services, yet I felt real hard pressed to let this girl off on her own devices, because there was also some suspicion on my part that there was some child abuse occurring in the family, both sexual and physical child abuse. And I guess my professional ethics constrained me from saying to her that I can no longer make any contact with you. So I persisted in terms of making frequent informal contacts, but never really got into serious treatment efforts with her. The upshot of this whole story is that 4 months down the line, because of her association with another student who had enrolled in our program, she came in with support of that friend and acknowledged that over the past 4 or 5 months, she had been grossly sexually and physically abused by her alcoholic father. And at that point, we were able to take action by contacting the State Children's Services Division. We were able to do something about that. My point here is not to perhaps portray the individual dilemma or perhaps even problems in dysfunctional families, but more to promote a larger perspective that indicates that based on my experience working with kids in this kind of setting, that I think the old proverb of the child is father to the man, or perhaps the child is mother to the woman, holds true, and that children who come from grossly dysfunctional family backgrounds, in the end up in many cases replicating the same problems that they were subjected to in their family. And I make that point because I think if one is dealing with the concerns of parents who feel that their rights are being abridged, one needs a rationale for taking those rights away from them. And I think when one studies the gross financial and social damage that is done on a larger societal level to the citizens of the state of Oregon, I think an adequate rationale can be developed. I would like to summarize by sharing with you some statistics that I accumulated, because several months ago I became aware of the particular predicament that this bill is addressing. And I tried to make an assessment of the direct impact on both our program, in other words, how many kids did we seriously approach with whom we were had to terminate our clinical relationship with because the parents failed to give consent to involvement in the program. And beyond that, in a larger sense, out of that entire population of school-aged children in the state, how many could we assume would be denied treatment services if they needed it, if they decided that they wanted to go out and secure that? So to that end, I constructed an experimental design survey, and I had it passed out randomly to about 450 kids in the Eugene School District. And the design was such that I was asking them two basic situational questions. One, if you were a child who had parents who were alcoholic, and you felt that you needed help with that problem, and there were services available to you, would you go seek out those services? And the second situation was one is, if you were an adolescent who was having drug and alcohol problems, and you were aware of the fact that you were having problems, and you felt like you needed help, and there were services available, would you seek it out? That was the control. The experimental design was we added the qualifier, if you were in that predicament and you needed the consent of parent before you could get those services, would you still seek out those services? And we found that out of both groups, those coming from alcoholic families and those who had drug and alcohol problems themselves, about one out of six kids said that if I were required to get the consent of my parent, I would not seek that help. I think that's real significant, and in fact, maybe an under-reflection of the true status of this problem in our community, because I think because the survey was distributed randomly, we were able to get data from a lot of kids who normally won't have those kinds of problems. And if we were to poll only those kids who found themselves in those predicaments, I think that we would find that a greater number or a higher percentage of those kids would not be willing to go and get help. The second thing I did was look at the number of students who had come into our program who we had to turn away. And I think the results of that study are even more remarkable. I think Lynn earlier referenced the fact that 25% of children approaching our student assistance program were turned away because their failure or their hesitancy in getting parent consent. That's really important if you project out the number of kids that we're expecting to see this year. We're talking about 300 kids, 25%, about 75 kids overall this year will probably be turned away from services. I think it's also significant that one of the attractive features of school-based mental health services is that they are destigmatized. And because of that fact, a lot of referrals to the program are self-referrals or peer referrals. I think one of the representatives earlier wanted to know the magnitude of this problem. And I think because of the fact that student assistance models are gaining a lot of popularity in the state, and in fact, because of their implementation, a lot more kids will have access to mental health services. I think the fact that in some rural communities, maybe only 20 kids call up the mental health center is not so significant, but when you look at the fact that 300 kids have access in the city of Eugene alone to our three programs, and there are possibilities for many more programs in the immediate future, we're talking about a very large number of kids. At any rate, out of those self and peer referrals to our program, which comprises about a third of our total, better than 50%, excuse me, 33% out of those self-referrals are kids who turned away. They came in initially on their own. They said, I want help, and we had to turn them away. And I think that hurts a lot because these are kids who are potentially at risk to commit the same kinds of problems that they're already experiencing in their family. That sort of, that concludes my testimony, and I do want to thank you for your time. I think this is a very critical issue, and I hope you give it due concern. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do you have your comments in writing by chance, or?
No, I don't.
If there's some, if you have time in the next week, is it possible that you could provide us a summary of your testimony?
Sure.
I found those statistics interesting.
Okay, I will do that.
I don't know if you have a sort of a summary of the study.
I think I could put it together on about a page.
That would be easy to read. I think be very helpful to us. Are there questions from the committee members? Thank you very much.
Sure, you're welcome.
Coming up here today. That's all the witnesses that are listed on 2651. Is there anybody else out there that wanted to testify that did not sign up? Okay, we'll close the hearing on 2651. We turn now to House Bill 2656. We do have some materials for the record. One is from Mr. Ken Jacobson. Make sure. Yes, that'll be made a part of the record. Also, a letter from Mr. David Oakes, dated March 21. We'll have that made part of the record as well. And then we also have some material. From AMI, which will be made part of the record, one document or two documents dated March 27th. Testimony from Mr. Walter Berry, Assistant Attorney General. Letter from the Oregon Health Science University. Dr. Joseph Bloom, dated March 21, 1985. I think the committee has copies of that material. In terms of House Bill 2651, I'm sorry, 2656. Could ask Mr. Amadon.
Example, I urge you and your committee not to approve passage of Bill 2656 for the following reasons. The bill assumes that individuals suffering from mental illness have the capacity to give expressed and informed consent before significant treatment procedures are concluded. Again, using my son as an example, and I've talked to many other parents who have children with the same or similar problem. I find that he is not unique. An example is the case of my son who suffers from schizophrenia and therefore impairing his ability to give such consent when he is suffering from a psychosis attack. In my son's case, these attacks have lasted for more than 2 months before his medication stabilizes his erratic thought disorder. He has had three attacks since 1983, which required hospitalization. During these attacks, he cannot distinguish what audio reality is or is not. Therefore, I ask you, can he possibly give expressed and informed consent to treatment? On page two of the bill, I have a problem with the fact that neuroleptic medication is not defined. At least I did not find any definition in the statutes for that. And page two, again, on line 33, limits non-consent treatment to 72 hours for neuroleptic medication treatment. As previously stated in my son's case, he has had to take a neuroleptic medication for many months to maintain his stability. Our son's treatment program would require him to continue taking this medication for at least 1 year before consideration is given to the elimination of it from his treatment program. In summary, House Bill 26 is not written with a concern for the patient's treatment in mind. The consent criteria is unrealistic, as is the 72-hour criteria. While neuroleptic medication is a concern in the treatment of any patient, it is valuable in the treatment of mentally ill patients and should not be restricted in the manner prescribed by this House bill. Again, I urge you not to approve passage of this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Remington, did the you have a prepared statement on this bill at this time, or did you want to submit one later?
Stevie Remington, Executive Director of ACLU of Oregon. We are in support of this bill, and we had expected to have a witness here today with prepared testimony. It will be forthcoming. I just called her, and it will be here by the end of the week.
Okay. I assume that it would be coming. I didn't know if I'd overlooked you or not. Representative Springer?
Stevie, just you may not know the answer to this. This was a subject of some work up during the interim, and I know that this matter may be the subject of litigation, and it may be that individual who's going to help us.
Yes, it is. We are co-counsel with the legal aid of Marion Polk County in the case on this, and Joyce Harpole is Stoll Reeves is the one who was to have prepared testimony. Says she will have it in.
Okay. Do you happen to know, just off the top of your head, if this language is modeled after any other states? It's my understanding two or three states, maybe more, have adopted different adjudicatory models for defining or trying to have, quote, an independent decision as to when a person is not in a position to give informed consent. Do you know which state this follows, or should we await that additional testimony?
If you have the testimony of co-counsel in that case, which is Ann Hubert and Phyllis Burke, okay, who are here, and they will be consistent with our position.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we ask Ann Hubert and Ms. Burke, were you going to testify also? Okay, great.
Maybe while they're distributing that, Mr. Chair, I'm trying to recall, seems to me we may have introduced a bill during the interim, but I'm not sure the bill number, or if that was a House or Senate side.
Senate Bill 414, okay, is what the bill, it's changed dramatically, and House Bill 2656 is much more extensive and much more specific than Senate Bill 414, okay, was, but it's very similar to that, and the interim joint committee, Judiciary Committee, looked at it briefly. Mm-hmm. In fact, they tabled it to look at it, but didn't really spend much time doing that in the interim.
Ms. Hubert, could you please identify yourself,
yes,
for the record, so we do not have that on.
Yeah, my name is Ann Hubert, and I'm an attorney at Marion Polk Legal Aid here in Salem, and the testimony is in support of House Bill 2656. I have passed out to you a number of exhibits. One is our written testimony, which is quite extensive. It's about 12 pages, just a legal analysis of where the courts are on this issue. I won't go into that. It's lengthy, and you can take time to read that as a resource. Also, passed out to you the, you were asking the question as to whether or not this was based on another state, and it is almost directly from the Rogers, which has had a number of different names in the last 9 years. It started out as Rogers v. Okun in Massachusetts, ended up to be Mills versus Rogers at the U.S. Supreme Court, and then was sent back down to Massachusetts because in the interim, Massachusetts had decided a case looking at this issue, so the Supreme Court sent it back to Massachusetts for them to make a determination. And it was Rogers versus Commissioner of Mental Health, the final decision that came out. And that came out in 1983. And also in the packet of materials you've been handed is the Rogers decision from the Massachusetts Supreme Court and the First Circuit, which adopted the Massachusetts Supreme Court decision, as well as the information from which the Department of Mental Health put out in Massachusetts to implement the Rogers case in the state of Massachusetts. It's how they're doing it and how they're reading the case. And it's modeled almost exactly on the decision that came out of the Massachusetts Supreme Court. Also, just to quickly go over what the exhibits are you've got, we've also submitted some testimony from Dr. Jeffrey Hyde, who's a private psychiatrist in Portland, who's also worked in state mental institutions. There is also some amendments to the bill that we wanted to add. Testimony from David Oakes, who is an ex-mental patient and lives in Eugene. The Oregon Administrative Rule on Informed Consent to Treatment. Since we mentioned it in our testimony, we thought you might want a copy of it to refer to. And also some testimony from Lucy Ted, who is a mother of a patient at Oregon State Hospital.